Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to The Hilo, the weekly current affairs and pop culture podcast brought to you by Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
It's been a big news week for many reasons, but of course the most important reason, the story on everyone's lips, the talk of the water cooler, is that in celebration of Eurovision, the cheesiest event in the world, flat-sharing site Spare Room launched a unique pizza topped with 41 different cheeses sourced from the 41 nations competing in this year's song contest. The ultimate homage to fromage was available for free from Baz and Fred's in Southwark, London, on the day of the competition.
Why was it available for free? It must have been quite expensive to make.
I did think that was not a particularly...
I couldn't even name
plan.
41 different types of cheese.
Neither could I.
Don't try right now. All that fromage for a deeply disappointing result because the UK came last again, which is deeply unfair considering that Slovenia sung the creepiest, slowest sort of death lullaby I've ever seen in my life. I did actually watch it this year, not live, I hasten to add, because I was out, because I'm a cool mum, but all 4 hours of it on Sunday morning with Zadie.
Oh, I should have watched it, because do you know what? I didn't realise it was Eurovision, which is my favourite cultural moment of the year.
Cultural moment.
Until I was listening to Graham Norton's Saturday breakfast show on Radio 2, which is the best way to start the weekend, and he was talking about Eurovision, and I very, very nearly rang my friends and cancelled my night out.
Well, Graham Norton was on excellent form. He introduced the model Bar Raffaelli as the ex-model Raffaelli, who he then just took a sort of mysterious dislike to for the rest of the show, at one point questioning the absence of her personality.
So harsh!
Also this week, Taiwan legalised gay marriage, the first state in Asia to do so. And Grumpy Cat has died age 7. The death of the Arizonian internet cat with feline dwarfism, whose permanent frown made her owners millions of dollars, died from a urinary tract infection, and the Moggy's passing made front cover stories on both broadsheet and tabloids.
I got a breaking news alert on my phone when it happened. My favourite story of this week is that the love of my life, Rod Stewart, has pledged £10,000 to a British model railway club, which was attacked by vandals at the weekend. He said he was devastated to hear about the Market Deeping Railway Club's exhibition being trashed by vandals and wanted to compensate those affected. So Rod is utterly obsessed with model railways. He has a whole room in his house dedicated to them and has spent 23 years building it. He has an entire chapter in his biography, the best book ever published, dedicated to it, in which he says he gets very, very angry when people infantilise him by calling them train sets. So they have to be called model railways.
Oh, right.
Anyway, I just thought it was a lovely story and another example of why he is my favourite musician and man on earth. And I'm also very much looking forward to seeing him live at York Racecourses in a couple of weeks, because India and I got a little bit drunk and booked some tickets to see it, which we forgot about until we were reminded by email a few days later.
York Racecourse. Have you bought your fascinator from Fenix?
No, it's not. It's not a part of the races. He's just doing a show there.
You're in India at the GGs.
I keep flagging it up, though. Like, everywhere. Whenever I'm interviewed at the moment, I keep flagging it up because I'm hoping that maybe his people might be listening and there might be a bit of a... I don't know.
His people might be listening.
Well, I spoke about it on when I went on Steve Wright in the afternoon a couple of weeks ago. And the head of the Rod Stewart online official fan club emailed my agent. And asked if I'd like to give a few words for the website, which was nice, but I was hoping for a little bit more. So if Rod Stewart's manager is listening, yes, I will come backstage, and yes, I will let him dedicate Maggie May to me. Okay.
That's the ever lofty Dolly Alton for you.
In more heartwarming news, an 81-year-old woman has met her mother for the first time after a six-decade search. Brought up in an orphanage in Dublin, Eileen McKen started looking for her mother aged 19. Last year, she appealed for help from Irish Radio, and in August, a genealogist called to tell her her mother was alive and living in Glasgow. Last month, she visited 104-year-old Elizabeth and said she wasn't quite sure if her mother fully understood their connection, but also said, "She never let go of my hand."
Also this week, Nigel Farage had a milkshake thrown over him and then pronounced that the attempt to cover him in milkshake whilst he stood covered in milkshake was a failure. And the Jeremy Kyle show was axed once and for all, although there is a change.org petition to bring it back, which has already garnered over 35,000 signatures.
I guarantee that is 90% students.
Dolly, I discovered an Instagram account this week that you are going to love. It's called @90sanxiety, and it has pictures of Hollywood stars during the golden grunge era, my favourite year of dress. I'm still inspired by that on a daily basis. Loads of pictures I've never seen before. Think Cameron Diaz in black Doc Martens, thick white sport socks, golden tan and a black cotton tank dress, sitting on the beach at Cannes like she's sort of Wes Wittering. It's absolutely magical.
I've got that picture of Cameron Diaz saved on my laptop because I just love the outfit so much.
Oh, you'll love the account then.
I'll follow it.
And loads of couples that you forget whatever couples as well, which, as you know, is my favourite thing to Google
that.
Image.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially the ones from the 90s, because I don't really remember the past lives of Winona Ryder or Gwyneth Paltrow, so it's a gem. What's in the mailbag this week, doll?
We had a number of emails in response to last week's author special with Bryony Gordon, including lots of messages from teenage girls who said the discussion made them feel better in themselves. One listener wrote us the following message a couple of hours before doing one of her GCSE exams. "I've just finished listening to the end of your recent episode with Bryony Gordon with my Greek GCSE in an hour.
Crikey, I don't envy you that.
I had been in the library this morning, but feeling on the point of meltdown, I had to retreat to my room and just lie, blinds closed, in the dark on my bed to calm myself down with an alarm set for 20 minutes. I was listening to you talking about GCSEs, and it made me feel so much better that I decided to jump out of bed and do 10 star jumps to wake myself up ready for the exam. GCSEs are a very stressful time, but I think if everyone just listened to the last 10 minutes of this episode, they would feel much better."
Dolly, do you ever just get out of bed and do 10 star jumps to prepare you for the high low?
No, but I'm the worst for it, I think. That was such a sweet message. I'm so glad that we were in your ears right before your GCSE, and I hope it went well. Another listener shared some really interesting insights into what it's like to be a young adult today. "I think that the ideals we are brought up with and the emphasis on how a good education will guarantee you a swift rise up the pay ladder means that I was disillusioned as a young adult. The feeling of failure that I'm not where I should be, coupled with what seems the common mid-20s self-doubt and crisis, is sometimes hard to deal with. There is a pressure to be in a super creative, flexible, modern career, often running your own business or working for yourself. But the reality is that the majority of people have traditional jobs. I sometimes feel awkward to say that I really enjoy my office-based 9-to-5 job and feel that modern media doesn't always represent or encourage the normal people like me. I don't think we should be shamed into not saying how much enjoyment and fulfillment we get out of the normal things in life and that our choices, no matter how boring, are always valid."
Thank you for that letter. I'm really glad you sent that
me
in.
Me too.
And I understand what you're saying. There is a lot of emphasis on having a sort of creative multi-hyphenate career. I mean, Dolly and I are very much included in that bracket, but there is nothing wrong with liking the strict barriers, both kind of physical and logistical, of an office-based job, and that's great.
And
that
both
you enjoy
and
it.
Both take equal amounts of hard work, diligence, skill, creativity. You know, I totally agree with you, and I do think it's something. When I read that email, I hadn't thought of that before, because I think perhaps I'm guilty publicly of fetishizing the sort of patchwork career that I've had. But as well as kind of talking about the benefits of having a career like that, I think we shouldn't forget that, as you say, those more traditional jobs are completely satisfying for many, 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 as she said, the majority of people, I think.
I'm increasingly going back the other way to having a 9-to-5 job at my desk, trying to leave my house as little as possible.
Yeah.
What have you been enjoying this week, doll?
I adored reading an absolutely beautiful and gorgeously descriptive homage to Doris Day in the New Yorker by Anthony Lane about her appeal to the masses, her vocal style and her film back catalogue and her kind of career choices. The payoff is particularly poetic and you can tell that the writer truly adores and understands her as an artist. But this section is the section that I wanted to read. To an extent, her success was due to physiognomy. Plenty of people have music in their soul. Doris Day had music in her face. So often and so instinctively did she break into a smile that her lips were already parted. It somehow seemed easier to carry on, open wide, and unleash a tune than to shut down and clam up. The song began where the smile left off. You sigh, the song begins. You speak and I hear violins. It's magic. That's her big number from Romance on the High Seas. And it doesn't take her long, two words, two syllables, one note, to vent that famous vibrato. It's more of a throb than a sob, and it instantly distinguishes Day from Judy Garland, who can stretch her vowels into a quivering so dense with need and regret that it's often hard to bear. Day is made of tougher stuff, determined not to surrender or to crumple, and reluctant to expose her heart in its entirety. Some of it should always be kept back, and there's no shame and plenty of solid sense in holding out for the bright side. Those are good vibrations.
I love that.
It's so beautifully written.
Doris Day had music in her face.
I know. And it's like, I don't know how he managed to, with so many people talking about the appeal of Doris Day and
that's
the very unique
fresh song.
Yeah, and also I love Judy Garland as well, so I love that description of how that vibrato and that fragility in and pain in Judy Garland's voice is almost unbearable in a way that the kind of soaring of Doris Day's isn't. It's just an absolute masterclass in description and observation, I think. So, yeah, it was beautiful and I loved it. I also loved an episode of Fresh Air last week in which Terry Gross played an archive interview from years ago where she rang Doris Day and interviewed her on the eve of Doris Day's 88th birthday, I think. It's a really special conversation for a number of reasons. Doris Day famously retreated from the public eye when she was approaching middle age. She kind of abandoned the entertainment industry and she went to go live somewhere very rural and rescue and rehome dogs and cats. And then she never gave interviews after that. And hearing her voice in the interview is kind of amazing because it's so much lower than the Bright Isabel voice that we remember from her films and her music. But Terry says at the beginning, she says, oh, you still sound exactly like Doris Day. And Doris Day is like, well, that's good, huh? And it's just a lovely interview and it's yet another example of why Terry Gross, I think, is probably the most deft interviewer this world has known. She's so gentle and thoughtful with her subject, particularly reverent in this case, as she's aware of what a privilege it is to be speaking with this like cultural towering figure. But also she doesn't shy away from asking searching questions or asking very straightforward questions in very odd conversational terrain. So, like, Doris Day doesn't seem to find it weird that she has 30 dogs. And Terry Gross, like, won't quite let go of, like, but why 30? And it's so funny because she just, Doris Day keeps coming back by saying, well, you know, I've got a lot of rooms. There are a lot of rooms. And it's like, a lot of people have big houses. So it's just,
She tries to ground her.
Yeah, and I just love Terry Gross and I was talking about this.
Did she write as well? Because I wasn't familiar with Terry Gross before Fresh Air.
So, no, but she's actually a really good interview with her, although it's really annoying because it's Marc Maron, so he keeps interrupting her and trying to be funny. But in terms of hearing about her past, is she did a live WTF with Marc Maron, and she's had a really fascinating past. And she has, and her talking about how she got into radio, but she actually, I think, has more of a legacy in longevity and history with her interviewing than Kirsty Young, but she's like treasured and celebrated in the same way like a Desert Island Discs presenter is treasured and celebrated.
And actually,
Laura Snapes is a massive fan of Terry Gross, and she was telling me that there's a brilliant book called All I Did Was Ask by Terry Gross, conversations with writers, actors, musicians and artists, and it's transcripts of her oral interviews. And Laura said her interview style becomes more apparent and takes on more significance when you see it in print.
Have you bought that book yet? That's got your name.
Yeah, no, I've ordered it. I really want to get stuck into the whole Terry Gross world and archive. Apparently there's also a great...
Tell me when you do and I will as well and then we can talk
okay,
about
great.
It.
Yeah, let's do it. There's also apparently a great, like, automated... Because Terry Gross asks really good questions and there's a really great automated, like, jokey thing on Google that's like... automated Terry Gross questions. It just throws up all these brilliant questions. Always recommend Fresh Air. It's the podcast that I think I go to most regularly. Mm-hmm. So do get into Fresh Air if you haven't already. I love Dead to Me, which Pandora recommended to me on Sunday when I was a little bit weary, having danced until 5 a.m. on Saturday night to a selection of Motown hits. I am so grateful for the recommendation, Panda, as it was not only great hangover viewing, it was just utterly compelling drama.
Well, we should thank India Knight, because I got it from her recommendation in her Sunday Times column this week. She said it was like Desperate Housewives. It really is like Desperate Housewives.
Yeah, I think it's better.
Because they've all got giant houses.
I know, I love the giant houses. I've got one episode left of it.
Me too!
Itching to get home.
I can't even
believe
I've got one left, though. I want like 40 more.
I know, it went too fast. It stars Christina Applegate, who is so, so good in it.
Yeah.
I think may have even become a better actor with age. And I also just love these quite unexpected casting choices that Netflix and Amazon often make, those shows. And it's about a woman who is widowed and left with two sons when her husband is killed in a hit-and-run car accident. She befriends another widow at a grief support group, and the series follows both the complications of their friendship and the mysteries of her husband's death and whether all is as it seems. I like a drama, and I love the pace of it and the addictive nature of the narrative. But I often find myself wanting more texture and character detail. But what has impressed me so much with this show is that the plot twists are so creative. The characters are so funny. It's plot driven, but it's also really character driven as well. And I think that's quite hard to find in a successful drama. And the reveals are just so real. All of it feels so real. None of it feels... You can't feel the hand of the writer in it at all, I don't feel.
And even though it deals with a fairly privileged set of people in Orange County, I think it is quite careful to cover, you know, people from different backgrounds and also lots of contemporary issues like repeated miscarriage or infertility or the kind of stigma of not being a homeowner or even having your own home at a certain age. It's really clever.
Yeah.
It's really, really well done. I'm so glad you're enjoying it.
Okay,
well,
I look forward to our WhatsApp conference this evening after we've both watched it. I also went back and re-listened to one of my favourite podcast episodes of all time with Jemima Kirk, who is incidentally my number one crush, and her best friend Lena Dunham. And it's from a few years ago, and it's from Lena Dunham's old podcast series that she did called Woman of the Hour. And
does she not do any of her media stuff anymore?
She's about to start a new podcast series on Luminary called The C Word, which is about how we have perceived and treated women we deem to be crazy through history, which I'm very much looking forward to listening to. But this one was a mini episode about friendship. And it's Jemima Kirk and Lena Dunham on driving on the way back from a weekend together. And it's them talking about the history of their friendship and the power dynamics of their friendship and what it was like to go from being friends to working together. And I think I just love women being honest about all these complications of female relationships, such as, you know, rivalry and jealousy and feeling left behind in competition. I just think it's so important to talk about this stuff because, you know, female friendship is like a much darker and messier and complicated thing than just being like girl crush sisterhood forever. And I think that that's like all a part of the experience. And, you know, it's very pertinent to me as well because I work with you. I work with another one of my best friends as well, Lauren. And transferring from friendship to a working relationship does have its challenges. It's incredible, but it's difficult as well. And I love listening to like really close female friends who work together be honest about that. And this conversation is ruthlessly truthful. And I'm interested in the fact that they talk at length about the fact that at school, Jemima Kirk was like apparently the coolest girl in the, that the school had ever seen. Apparently when Lena Dunham would go around to her house, like, Moby would be there eating a pizza, and she was clubbing when she was 14 years old, and she just so vividly conjured up this girl that I think all of us knew when we were younger. Maybe not with those exact same cultural references, but those girls that yield power. And she, and Lena Dunham says, you know, my version of our story is that when I met you, I was completely besotted with you, and I ran around doing everything that you wanted me to do. And Jemima Kirk has said, yes, well, that was kind of my MO when I was a teenager, is that I wanted to find sort of weak people who I could just control. And then when Lena Dunham went to university and then became this, like, incredibly young
auteur.
Yeah. And it's such an interesting chat where Jemima then became Lena's muse and Lena became Jemima's boss. And Jemima said, I felt like you were making me into a caricature on girls because you were trying to exert authority over me because you had resentment of so many years that I was the more powerful one.
And did Lena say she had?
I think she said, yeah, like a little bit. It's so interesting. I'm amazed that this conversation is so hidden in the kind of podcast store. Because you have to really go and find it. And it's just two very, very self-aware people in terms of in relation to their emotions to each other in this specific conversation. So, yeah, I loved it. And I actually wanted to insert a clip here because it reminded me a bit of me and you, Panda. Because at the end, Lena says, I think we should end by lovingly saying the most annoying qualities about each other. And Jemima says one about Lena, which you regularly have said about me.
Another annoying thing about you. Oh, you check out in your head when sometimes when in conversations, not necessarily to me, like it's not annoying, it's just interesting because you do it when you're talking.
It can be annoying.
I saw you do it on the Ellen show.
You did see me. You saw me stare into the abyss
on the Ellen. I was watching Ellen. I was like, she's gone, lights are on, no one's home. And I pointed it out and my husband was like, yeah, totally.
I also did a massive WTF catch up because I haven't listened to it for a while, and he's had some great guests on in the last couple of weeks, including Angelica Houston,
which is that amazing interview with Vulture.
Yeah,
if you haven't read it yet, googled it, it's like the ultimate celebrity interview. It's there's some like quite problematic things in it, but she's also very funny about how her and Ryan O'Neill snogged for like 6 hours on a snooker table or something, and the interviewer's like, how did you kiss for that long? And she's like, I was young, my back was like liquid amber.
She's so funny, and she's like, as you say, refreshingly candid. And actually, in terms of the very, very problematic things that she said within that interview, for me, it was basically her saying it was a bit of a boys will be boys, it was a different time, in terms of excusing sexually bullying or abusive behaviour. And for me, when I read it, I was obviously disappointed when she said that, but I just also thought, this is obviously a woman who's been traumatised by men over the years. Truly, that's what I felt. It's like, this is a woman for whom she's obviously been so objectified and had, I can't speculate, but I assume from what she's just reading between the lines of the interview, that has had so many uncomfortable experiences that I think it's become normalised for her as a coping mechanism. So, I don't know, I wouldn't be so quick to vilify her on that, even though, as I said, I do agree that the things she said were problematic. But the one that, the episode that I wanted to really flag to everyone is Brené Brown, who is an astonishingly inspiring public speaker and social worker. And she did a TED talk years ago, which I talked about on the High Low, because it's available to listen to as a series on Audible, called The Power of Vulnerability.
That is cited, I feel like even Michelle Obama cited it in her speech. Like, how many times has it been listened to? It must be one of the most listened to pieces of audio content.
It's a radical piece of thinking, and it's about the fear that we have around vulnerability, why we have a fear around vulnerability, where it stems from in childhood, and the link between vulnerability and shame. And, you know, as someone who, this was a lot of work that I did in therapy, I am petrified of vulnerability, both in relationships, in my family life, in friendships, you know, health-wise, like, I'm a person who hates even being sick. Like, I'm so fearful of being dependent on others. It was such a life-changing experience listening to this woman convince me of how vulnerability is bravery, and how it, when harnessed correctly and appropriately, it's the only route to feeling authentic, known, understood, and intimate with others. So, yeah, she's an amazing woman. Do listen to that. And then the WTF episode is Marc Maron. I was really surprised he wanted to get her on, because Marc Maron is like a pretty cynical guy, and she is funny and has moments of being acerbic, but is very sincere and incredibly open-hearted. But he's completely obsessed with her, and he says in the intro that he's tried to get her on before, and that, that the power of vulnerability was one of the most important things that he's ever listened to. And it's interesting listening to their dynamic, because normally with Marc Maron, he's completely in charge of the show. He's very kind of slapdash with his questions. You feel like the guests are very much there in his space. But he is really keen to impress Brené Brown, and he offends her at a couple of points, and she really snaps at him in a way that I've never heard a woman on his podcast do before. Like, at one point she was like, "You're being really fucking rude," about when he says that he thinks that she's a control freak. So it's just like really, and I'm a big fan of Marc Maron, but I do sometimes find him quite abrasive. So it was really great to listen to this woman who just knows herself and knows her own boundaries really take control of that conversation. And the bit that I would like to insert here is when they're talking about shame and how we move through a world where, quite rightly, and thank God, we are taking people to task and reprimanding them on bad behaviour in a public way, but how we do that while consciously removing shame from the methodology.
For me, I think shame is a tool of oppression. Humiliation, berating are tools of hurt. They're not going to be tools of change and justice. I do not think shame is a social justice tool. And if you want to use it as a social justice tool, that's great. I'm not going to participate in that with you, because shame doesn't just change the person who is the target of the shame. Shame changes people who use it against other people. So if you want me to, hey, this person did something really shitty, really bad, and let's shame the shit out of them.
Yeah.
Don't include me. You want to hold that person accountable in a real way? I'm on board. But just FYI, that takes 10x the amount of time and work that shame does. You won't get the rush of feeling good by berating someone right away. Mm-hmm. And it's a long process. But I will not participate in using shame as a social justice tool. It's the justice tool of oppression.
I like how you got really meta on that. You were looking at the kind of shifting dynamic between interviewer and interviewee in a sort of audio setting as much as you were actually looking at the content. You are the ultimate podcast enthusiast. you are a podcast. I read Home Fire by Camilla Shamsie last week, and I am completely blown away by it. I'm not sure how it took me so long to become conscious of it. It staggers me sometimes. Do you ever have this, that I can miss something that's been widely lauded, you know, hugely well read, has won prizes, and it still sort of floats by my conscious. So this book, Home Fire, won Women's Prize for Fiction last year, but it only really came to my attention, and I bought it last week after it was recommended to us by a lot of Hilo listeners off the back of our author special with Fatima Bhutto, whose book The Runaways is about teenagers who join ISIS. Home Fire deals with a similar storyline, but also not at all, because it's also a book about class and family and the trauma of being orphaned and social identity and politics. It is tremendously clever. It is a modern retelling of the Greek myth of Antigone. Antigone is the daughter of Oedipus and his mother Jocasta. Yes, note the Oedipal relationship there. And she is very close to her brother, and it's a relationship which is replicated in Anika and Parvaz in Home Fire, except that Anika is an LSE student and Parvaz has run away to join the media unit of ISIS. I can't really do this book justice because it is so much more than that storyline. It's so acutely observed and beautifully written. And the ending is honestly
the most heart-in-mouth cliffhanger. I am desperate to know what other people think happened after this book, like on the next page of it.
In a frustrating way? Or
Because I'm terrible at everything not being like tied up in a neat little book. The ambiguity is obviously part of the power. I've Googled it. I've implored people by tweet to come and discuss with me. But all people do is keep replying to me saying how amazing this book is and it's like their favourite book and they've read it 16 times. I agree. It's fucking fantastic. But I really need to talk about what would happen on the next page of this book. It was Mental Health Awareness Week last week, which is why we had Brani Gordon on to discuss mental health in teenage girls and women, and which I totally forgot to flag last week. But there was some excellent content from the BBC. Louis Theroux on postnatal depression, which I talked about last week. Nadia Hussein on anxiety. And the actor David Harewood on being sectioned into his 20s in a programme called Psychosis and Me.
Oh, I really want to watch that.
It was brilliant. He dove into the specifics of his psychotic attack itself, how it built, you know, how it came to be and why. He looked at how identity played a role in his psychosis. For him, the contributing factors were being very successful almost as soon as he left RADA, but desperately lonely, living in London without his family who lived in Birmingham, and being constantly defined as a black actor. He said it's not something he'd thought of himself as before until he played Othello, and everyone kept referring to it as, you know, the black Shakespeare play, or he was the black Othello, or, and in all these ways that contributed to him feeling just
erased
and also just built to this idea of just feeling very alienated and very alone and I think confused by the way his life is playing out. He also discussed the connotations of the word psychosis. It implies someone who's crazy and scary and unstable, he says. Most people prefer to say they had a breakdown. In one really moving scene, he recreates the journey to the hospital where his two friends from RADA took him when it was clear he was in the middle of his psychotic episode. It's very emotional to watch. It's lovely that these are two close friends 30 years later, and when he's clearly very upset by it, the way they just all gathered together as men that have known each other for, you know, 3 decades, and he just keeps saying, fucking hell, this is fucking real, fuck, because he sort of has been retelling it, you know, as an actor, and then suddenly he's back where it sort of, you know, happened. Thanks to various doctors who are interviewed, we also learned some really interesting facts about psychosis. 80% of first episode psychosis happens before the age of 24, and it's something that commonly develops during adolescence, as it's a fertile field, the changing pubescent brain, experimenting with drugs and alcohol. I thought that was really interesting. I didn't realise how kind of youth orientated psychotic episodes were. The form of psychosis, and I found this really interesting, is always the same, but people bring different content, one psychiatrist says. For example, religion used to be involved in a lot more delusions. Mm. Think of The Exorcist. Mm. But now we are a more secular society. A lot of it is now about social media.
That's so interesting.
And psychosis will affect 1 in 100 people. So it's a lot more common than I thought. A really interesting show, and I thoroughly recommend. And David Harewood did a brilliant job with this, because it's personal and it's social and it's psychological, and it's it really deftly moves between kind of personal memoir and culture and psychological stigma, I think, as well.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The state of modern humanity's sense of connection and community has been the subject of conversation this week off the back of an unexpected source. Uber is offering its customers the option of a quiet ride via the app, which means the driver will not attempt conversation or small talk. It is currently only available to users of its luxury Uber Black services, costing the passenger extra. The news has divided both drivers and riders. Some have commented that this is an example of conscious, malicious class division, or that it dehumanises drivers. Others have said that the silence is easier for both driver and passenger to have clear boundaries and know what's required of both of them to be appropriate. Some women have said they feel safer being alone in an Uber if there is no conversation. And I saw that some deaf Uber customers were tweeting that this makes life easier and more comfortable for them. It really seems to have divided people. What are your thoughts, Panda?
I don't know if I agree with the dehumanising bit, which came from the Mirror instantly, as I do think in any service job, there are customers who want to chat and people who don't want to chat, whether you're a hairdresser or a cab driver. And I do think that's part and parcel of the job, is navigating your customer.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that even goes as far as in waitressing, or I worked in a shop for years and I knew you had to, as part of the job, it was about gauging what was an appropriate level of interaction and what people wanted.
Yeah, I think they're consumer facing jobs. What I do think that this new service would allow is a further erosion of our ability to be ad hoc communicators. That's what really worries me. So that if communication isn't planned in advance, like, hi, I'm going to call you at 1:30 today, or written so that you can reply at your own leisure, then we just can't cope. And I think that we should be able to actually say, and have to say, without flipping a little switch, sorry, I'm just working on something at the moment. Do you mind if we don't chat? Rather than being able to swipe an app and rest easy in the knowledge that you have avoided conversation with someone you don't know yet again.
I'm in two minds about it, which surprises me, because normally I'm very oldie-woldy, let's despair about the breakdown of conversation in community, as you know. I use Uber quite a lot, which provides a lot of material for mockery from my friends.
I said absolutely nothing.
And often when I use Uber, it's because I need to answer emails in between appointments. So in the past, there have been times where I found it frustrating to make conversation, only because I don't want to appear rude, but the whole reason I'm in a quiet car with signal is to get some work done. I have to say that is very rare, though, as most Uber drivers I get in a car with are either quiet, listening to the radio, or on the phone. And I have to say, I think it cuts both ways. I'll always try and pick up on whether they want to chat or whether they would prefer to be left alone. The other day I was in an Uber and I said, would you mind if I take a call? One of my bosses is ringing me. And he said,
that was me, by the way, I'm one of my bosses.
And he said, not at all. Would you mind if I took a call? And I said, yes, go ahead. And we both like sat very quietly having conversations on the phone throughout the journey, which I felt was completely fair. What I think feels uncomfortable or imbalanced is the idea that the passenger is the one who gets to control the entire mood of the car and the journey. I've always felt that a cab journey is about both people respecting what sort of journey the other person wants. Personally, I think there should be an option for Uber drivers to select when they want a journey in quiet mode.
I think that's very civil of you. I think a lot of people will disagree. I think they will say, well, I'm paying for this service, therefore I get to dictate the mood.
I don't think I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a particularly nice way to approach human behaviour, but I do think it has become the default way for us to think, I'm paying for this, therefore it's the idea of the customer always being right, which is so problematic.
No, I don't agree with that.
I think all too often we see Ubers not as taxi drivers, but as their own entity. And it's, you know, imagine if you said to a black cabbie, can you stop pointing out the sights of London, thanks. And you know, I think sometimes we think of them as like different sorts of people rather than
what, Uber drivers.
Yeah,
well, they're also within that lays some very uncomfortable racism, I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
They're totally
and definitely as well, there is an idea that one is elevated over another, isn't it?
Yeah.
When I feel car sick, which is very often, unfortunately, I find talking agonising. So I try and do it with minimal lip interaction, like I'm a ventriloquist. But I do think that we need to be careful not to seal ourselves into a sound-controlled booth where the only conversation permitted is with people we know, trust and agree with. The famous cliche I always come back to, I've said it on the podcast before, I've written it before, I will say it and write it again, is that community is breaking down because we don't chat at bus stops anymore. We swipe instead. We are, as Eric Thomas put it in a piece for LUS, which made me laugh, aggressively antisocial. Mm. It's no longer passive, this reluctance to converse. It's actually aggressive.
Yeah. Yeah, I really feel that when I leave London, and it's something I have to really smack my wrist about. That whenever, generally when I leave London and go to more rural communities, I'm always astonished at how much
chattier.
How much, just it's a part of moving through your day, is just conversation with sort of everyone. And what astonishes me and appalls me even more is how intolerant I am of it. And I think that's something I'm really trying to push back against, because I think that is, first of all, a symptom of of our times and a symptom of urban living, but also the fact that I live alone. And I don't want to be aggressively antisocial. I really, really don't. In relation to this specific conversation about silence in Ubers, I have to say I found some of the conversation around it to be quite patronising. I saw a few people tweeting something along the lines of, if we stop speaking to Uber drivers, then Uber drivers might not have any human interaction in their entire day. And I just felt like that's quite an offensive thing to say. I'm pretty sure most Uber drivers have lives and friendships and families. And also a lot of people work in jobs that isolate them or mean a working day with no chit-chat. I really don't think this is about a duty to maintain the contentment or mental health of Uber drivers by talking about roadworks or the weather. I think it's a larger question of politeness and community and connection.
Yeah, it's very odd to other Uber drivers who are entitled to their own internal lives and social lives. I came close to writing a novella about Uber drivers after a trip to LA 3 years ago when I got 25 Ubers in 3 days.
Fuck me, that's like Marie Antoinette.
Now, before you yell at me via our mailbag, I Uber pooled every single time at an average cost of $4 per journey. And I was there for work, which meant multiple meetings and interviews in places I had zero idea of how to get to. LA is vast and sprawling. I didn't have a car, and the LA bus route is pretty appalling if you don't know where you're going. Most of the Uber drivers there actually just clocked on as an extra job. I had a few students, but my favourite was Darlene, who was usually a stay-at-home mum, but she Ubered in the evenings and drove almost exclusively on the pavements. It was a wild ride.
On the whole, I really worry about how little we communicate face-to-face now. It's why I hate WhatsApp and automated helplines and self-checkout counters.
Which never work.
They never work. You have to look at this model when there are 10 self-checkout counters and 5 staff walking up and down them helping people use them. It's like, this just has no logic. And also selfie sticks. Can you remember the last time that a couple or a group of friends or a family came up to you and said, excuse me, will you take a photo of us? It just doesn't happen anymore. And it just feels like another excuse
not to have to talk to people.
And I really do worry that we are losing not only a desire to speak to each other, but an interest in learning about each other and curiosity. But I do think with taxis, whether Uber or a minicab or a black cab, it's such a specific environment, particularly if you're a lone passenger, that is strangely intimate. Just you and a person you've never met in a car. That the question of conversation really is more personal, as it's not like you're just passing through somewhere or in a communal area.
That's a fair point. I think you're right. The intimacy means that it actually can feel more claustrophobic. And so there needs to be a kind of added awareness of that enforced hole.
Totally. And as I say, I think it's a personal choice for both driver and passenger. Here's an example. I tried to make small talk on Saturday night with my cab driver, and it was very, very clear that he didn't want to talk to a tipsy girl giddy from a night out. So I shut up pretty quickly. And I think we need to think of the experience of a cab journey as being two people judging what's appropriate rather than just a passenger waltzing in and deciding what the atmosphere of the journey is going to be.
Did you do your good evening, good man? I would like to be taken to the borough of Camden, please, through this fair town with its twinkly lights shtick.
And don't spare the horses. No, I didn't actually, though. A bit of personal trivia to finish the segment. When I wrote my dating column for the Sunday Times Style, I spent a journey from Tottenham Court Road to Highgate flirting with a very hot cab driver and gave him my number.
Did he have a ring?
No.
Like many of you, I'm sure, this week all I have been talking about and thinking about is the new Alabama abortion ban. Last week, 25 white male Republicans voted in the most restrictive abortion law in the states. In addition to banning nearly all abortion, including pregnancies resulting from rape or incest, except in cases where the pregnancy poses a serious health risk to the mother, doctors who perform the procedure can be convicted of a felony and jailed for life. To clarify, say you sought an abortion after being raped, the doctor who performed your abortion would likely get a longer jail term, between 10 and 99 years, than your rapist. Alabama is the first state in the states to ban abortion, but, and this is where it gets a little sticky, whilst it is legal in all the other states via the landmark 1973 case of Roe versus Wade to procure an abortion, other states have made it very difficult, such as having only one abortion clinic in the entire state, for example.
further reading on this is Spark of Light by Jodi Picoult, a piece of fiction based on the One Health Clinic that provides abortions in Mississippi. Both Dolly and I really enjoyed that. Was it last summer? I think we flagged it.
Yeah.
Or they have laws which ban abortions after 6 weeks, which is before a lot of women know they are pregnant. Georgia, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, and Ohio have all recently passed so-called heartbeat bills, which ban abortions once the fetal heartbeat is detected around 6 to 8 weeks. Utah and Arkansas limit the procedure to the middle of the second trimester. So whilst this is about Alabama, it's also about the start of something where the domino effect could lead to a reversal of women's rights across America. I need hardly explain why this is such devastating news for women. It will impact poor women most significantly because poverty is the number one predicator to abortions. It also affects minority women more significantly as the majority of women who seek abortions are women of colour. How will this affect women's mental health, forced to carry and raise children that they are not equipped to have or to raise? How will this affect the social and psychological identity of those children, many of whom will undoubtedly be placed in care? Who will be plugging the inevitable financial shortfall in the foster and care system from the increase in children? And of course, the disability sector, as plenty more children with disabilities will be born. Who will be funding the inevitable decline in women's mental health? Alabama is currently 41st in America's healthcare rankings, so it hardly looks rosy on that front.
Like every woman I know, I spent so much of last week in a state of fury and couldn't stop thinking about those 25 men. Trump himself has flip-flopped on the issue. He claimed he was pro-choice, and then in March 2016, as a Republican presidential candidate, he confirmed in response to an interviewer's question, "So there has to be some form of punishment for the woman?" Yes, there has to be some form. Days later, he evaded those comments in an interview with New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd. She wrote, "Given his draconian comments sending women back to back alleys, I had to ask, when he was a swinging bachelor in Manhattan, was he ever involved with anyone who had an abortion?" Trump's response, "Such an interesting question. So what's your next question?" On Saturday, he clarified, "I'm very strongly pro-life with the three exceptions, rape, incest and protecting the life of the mother." The same position taken by Ronald Reagan. Although, of course, the former of those two exceptions have not made it into the new Alabama law.
Last Sunday, three major Alabama newspapers devoted their Sunday editions to letters from women across the state. The Birmingham News, the Huntsville Times and the Mobile Press Register filled their Sunday pages with 200 essays from Alabama women of various backgrounds, ages and political leanings. The essays are also available as a package online under the title "It's Time to Hear Alabama's Women." We'll link to that in the show notes. Though the state was the talk of the nation last week, wrote Alabama Media Group's Vice President Kellyanne Scott in an introduction to the series, missing from many of those conversations were the voices of women from this state.
The essays included these chilling words from teenager Isabel Hope. "I don't feel safe walking alone ever. How am I supposed to feel knowing that if something were to happen, I would have no options?"
Abortion is a nuanced issue, but it is not an issue that I sit on the fence about, and nor will I feel even an iota of temptation to be anything other than furious and voluble on this issue. I have not had an abortion, but that does not mean that I do not fiercely support the choice of any single woman who is not capable of bringing a child into this world to have one. Until women have autonomy over their bodies, we do not live in an equal society. We may see Christine Blasey Ford being given a voice to speak out about her sexual assault from Brett Kavanaugh, but he was still installed in the Supreme Court. And I don't think that Me Too and the increase in women's voices is unconnected to the ban in Alabama. There are many men who do not want women to be equal, and what better way to restrict their power and agency than with a bill like this?
It is the most biblical method of controlling a woman's freedom.
What angers me the most is that people in favour of banning abortion are called pro-life. They are not pro-life, in my opinion, because to be pro-life would be to be invested in the life of both the baby and the woman. What they are, said Janice Turner in her Times column, is pro-cellular life. "Protect the unborn, but the born can go to hell," she writes. In the anti-abortion camp, a woman barely counts as a human. It's like she's seen as just this host body. If male politicians could get pregnant, there would be as many planned parenthood clinics as there are post offices, tweeted everyone's favourite congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
The US itself is not exactly united on the issue. In a 2018 poll, 59% said that abortion should be legal in all or most cases, but 37% thought it should be illegal in all or most cases. Abortion has always been a flammable topic in the US, most famously attributed to evangelical Christians, or what's colloquially known as the Bible Belt, a swathe of states which stretches from Texas to North Carolina.
The abortion ban won't just affect women who have abortions, but women who have miscarriages too, because healthcare providers cannot actually tell whether someone is having a natural miscarriage or an induced miscarriage. They will have to interrogate them thoroughly about their pregnancy. And if there are language barriers, then it could only take one faltered word for you to be a suspect in a criminalised abortion. Imagine working there as a midwife or a doctor, medical professionals forced to become detectives.
The author and midwife Clemmy Hooper, who has a very popular Instagram account, posted a photo on Instagram which said abortion is healthcare. And I was so shocked at some of the vile and ignorant comments underneath the post. Supposedly pro-life women who lambasted her for supporting a woman's right to access abortion, many of whom took particular umbrage with it because Clemmy is a mother of four and because she, her job, her profession is bringing life into the world.
I'm a mother and I feel more passionately about abortion than I ever have because I know what it takes to grow, birth and raise a child. And that was doing it when I really wanted that child. Doing that when you don't want that child, when you don't feel able, must be one of the very worst feelings in the world.
The perfectly obvious fact is mothering and caring about children is not in opposition to abortion.
Totally.
In fact, it's very much a part of being invested in the notion of life, bringing life into the world and raising happy and healthy children. It's telling that, as you say, Pandora, nearly every woman I know who's had a baby and is now caring for a baby and understanding the impact of becoming a parent has said they've become even more pro-choice than they were before. Having a child is one of the most enormous decisions a human can make. And this fucking faux moralistic simplification from the side of anti-pro-choice is just so hard to engage with calmly, I think.
And to caveat, I understand that some people would never want to procure an abortion themselves. You know, that if they were to get pregnant, they would never want to end the life of that fetus.
Of course.
What is so terrifying about laws like this is it doesn't allow people that agency. It's making decisions on behalf of every single woman. So you have to separate personal choice from political, because this is political, this is not personal.
And also, I think what we have to understand in these conversations is that being deeply invested in this fundamental freedom for women does not mean taking the option of abortion flippantly or lightly.
Legalising abortion does not lead to a surge in women getting abortions. Legalised abortion leads to a surge of women getting, like, healthy, legal abortions, not dangerous abortions in backstreet alleys. It's not like encouraging women to get abortions, because people don't seek abortions, as Dolly says, flippantly. This isn't something that you just do like you're buying a fucking sandwich. When I posted this news on Twitter, a lot of people responded about Northern Ireland. I saw the issue as different because Alabama is a new law, whereas the rule in Northern Ireland is a historical one that I believe, like in Ireland last year, will be revoked. But on further reading, I can see that I was wrong to assume that it's somehow not as urgent, because in many ways it's actually stricter than the Alabama law. Alabama would lock up the doctor who performed an abortion, but it wouldn't jail the woman. Whereas in Northern Ireland, under the 1861 Act, that's how old it is, this is the case. And as Janice Turner wrote in the Times, this isn't some dormant law. A mother in Northern Ireland was recently charged for acquiring abortion pills for her teenage daughter. We are, she writes, ignoring our own Alabama.
A Northern Irish listener wrote into us when the news from Alabama broke. She writes, "There is an assumption that the Northern Irish laws will be revoked soon, and it is this flippancy that creates inaction and stalls progression for the 28 Northern Irish women who travel every day for abortion care that is currently illegal in all cases in the North. Yes, the restricting of abortion laws is terrifying. Yes, it is like the beginning of The Handmaid's Tale. But what we need is not outraged tweets and Instagram posts on women's rights, but British citizens demanding actual change. Northern Ireland has not had a sitting government for 2 years now, and the DUP, headed by Arlene Foster, are a party who are probably dancing around their offices right now due to the passing of such laws in Alabama. This is a party who your sitting government are in alliance with, who Theresa May signed a deal with, and who your government currently relies on. So channel outrage by letting them know exactly what you think. Contact and support London Irish Abortion Rights Campaign and fight for your fellow citizens who are already under Alabama-esque laws. I write this as an Irish woman who has travelled to the UK for care, who grew up in a country with no respect for women's bodily autonomy, and who bled on an airplane seat in the hope no woman should ever repeat that journey.
Thank you so much for that letter. Our conversation is so much better for its addition.
Northern Irish journalist Elizabeth Nelson wrote for The Guardian on the subject. Because abortion is freedom to whoever needs it, there is no such thing as a more extreme abortion law. An abortion denied to an asylum seeker in Ireland without the papers to travel and whose pregnancy has gone beyond 12 weeks is as extreme as the mother in Alabama who has two children and for whom a third could push her into poverty. The university student whose birth control failed and who is denied an abortion because the embryo already has a heartbeat will find the law as extreme as a rape victim who cannot access healthcare to help her to take her life back. The denial of abortion to someone who needs one is in itself extreme. It's not about when someone ends a pregnancy or why. It is about controlling women's bodies and choices in life. It is punishment. Anyone who's lived in a place without free, safe and legal abortion can tell you this. In Northern Ireland, our hearts break for Alabama because we know what's coming. Threats, prosecutions, seizure of safe but illegal abortion pills, shame, families and friends turning each other into the authorities, fear. I think this point about abortion being freedom, a human right regardless of a tier system of our perceived severity factors, is really important to remember in this particular conversation. There were a lot of powerful images that were circulating in the wake of this news, and one that I found particularly arresting was an image of a pie chart titled Reasons Why Women Have Abortions, and every section of the pie chart says none of your business.
I think that's a really interesting point to raise. I was just thinking while you were talking there, and I definitely do feel myself getting more outraged and saddened by the idea of someone being pregnant through rape or incest than someone becoming accidentally pregnant in a less violent scenario. As you say, the idea of kind of reducing it to a tier system of perceived severity factors isn't very helpful and perhaps takes away from the conversation. I can't deny, and I'm sure a lot of people will feel, that there are instances where your heart breaks particularly,
of course,
hearing of anyone being pregnant through rape. But ultimately, it's an extreme law, as you say, however it's parlayed. And also, we need to be careful. And I remember when we were discussing the revoking the law on abortion in Ireland last year on the high low, there was a lot of kind of tweets going around with people saying, you know, when people are saying, well, abortion isn't just about, you know, a girl who got drunk and shagged someone and now doesn't want a baby because she's 19. Like, those women count too. Mm-hmm. You know, we're sort of succumbing to that same sense of division and moralising when we start picking out which circumstance is more deserving of an abortion than another.
With human rights, it's fundamental. It's a right or it isn't.
Yeah, and I think that was a really important point that you made and that Elizabeth Nelson made for The Guardian. We can't do anything about Alabama except carry on making a noise about it, but we can focus on our own Alabama, Northern Ireland. There has been a surge in pressure on Westminster to abolish the 1861 Act in the wake of the Alabama ruling, and a campaign calling on pro-choice supporters to email their MPs to demand action has seen 200 emails sent to politicians every hour since its launch. The hashtag NowForNI campaign, which is being organised by the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, BPAS, encourages women to email their local MP. The email campaign was launched at midday on Wednesday and had clocked up 12,000 emails by Friday evening. It's such an easy thing to do, to email your local MP, and I genuinely never think to do it, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. I'm going to be doing that today, and I'll be sharing that across my social media for others to do the same. I know we said earlier that this sort of idea of just posting on social media doesn't do anything, but sometimes I think it can. And I think in this case, actually, that pressure on the government and on Theresa May to address this with the DUP, I think will be really fundamental, actually.
Another option to take action is to donate to the Abortion Support Network, which provides financial assistance and accommodation to people travelling from Northern Ireland, Malta, Gibraltar and the Isle of Man to access legal abortion. The High Low has just made a donation and we will put the link in the show notes if you would like to show your support to women whose reproductive rights are not their rights at all.
Thank you very much for listening to The High Low. You can rate, review and subscribe. It helps other people find us and boosts us in the charts. You can email us, thehighlowshow@gmail.com, or tweet us at The High Low Show. Bye-bye.
Bye.